किमिहन्दस्य जनजनस्मृतयः चक्षुस्मिलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले सायं रूपकदामयं ददाति सदाशिवम्। Srimad Bhagavatam describes the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his most intimate and confidential nature. If we look at the example of, say, a king, or more commonly, the president or prime minister, it's generally seen that what the king is doing in his private apartments, in his private house, is not seen by ordinary people. In different countries, there's different habits about how much the reporters like to report these things. But really, we don't find out very much of what they do in their private lives. Why is that? There's a practical reason. Because the king, or the prime minister, or the president, to do his job or to take his position, he requires the complete respect of all the people. He requires that. And there, as the expression goes, familiarity breeds contempt. If we see that the king, or we see him at the breakfast table, we see him playing with his children, or watching television, or going to the movies, or doing this, or arguing with this one and arguing with that one, and eating, what to speak of, whatever he does for relaxation, then we'll think, oh, he's just like me, and therefore, why should I listen to him? Because Krishna has pastimes that are ultimately in Naralila. They are ultimately parallel, or I was going to say they are parallel to the activities of human beings, but actually human beings' activities are reflections of the activities of Krishna. So it is only to those, Krishna reveals those activities, or the king or the prime minister or the president reveals his most intimate activities only to those who are most trusted, who have enough love, affection for him, and trusted love and affection, that they will not misuse that information. They won't sensationalize it just to create some fame or some money for themselves. And sometimes this happens when the king's butler or something, he decides to write a book about all the intimate dealings within the palace. It creates a great stir because the common people are always eager to hear these things. But actually, they are not qualified to hear because their respect for the king, the position of the king, the position of the president, the position of the prime minister goes down because they are just common people. And no one wants to accept the fact that they are just a common person, that there's billions and billions of us, hundreds and thousands and millions and billions and quadrillions of insignificant spirit souls, common spirit souls inhabit this earth. Ordinary, cycling from body to body to body, conditioned, controlled by the material energy. No one likes to hear this. Everyone likes to think how special I am. But actually, the greatest qualification is humility, because that allows us to see that we're just ordinary. And once we see we're just ordinary or less than ordinary, that we're fallen souls, then the size of our hat size will shrink to actually its insignificant proportion. Instead of thinking how wonderful we are, we think we're insignificant. And then we can accept some mercy and some kindness from above. And then we can become trusted in our devotion. So if this is true on the level of the president and the prime minister, and soon as one hears the indiscretions of these leaders, then people lose their respect for them. But in Krishna's case, what he does is all completely transcendental. He is not at all touched by the modes of material nature. Practically speaking, actually speaking, it's impossible for a conditioned soul, a soul who is covered by the modes of material nature, covered and controlled by the modes of material nature, to have a full understanding or very much of an understanding of what the spiritual world is like. A devotee who is under the modes of material nature, he's aspiring to be a devotee, because Sagonan Samatityaitan Brahmabhuyaya Kalpate. When one is performing devotional service continuously, that means that one is actually a devotee. Mam Chayo Vivacharena Bhakti Yogena Sevate. Continuously, unflinchingly, then one is actually a devotee. So we, under the control of the modes of material nature, are not allowed by the modes of material nature to perform this kind of devotional service, because our purity and therefore our sincerity isn't great enough. So for those devotees, what to speak of conditioned souls who have completely conditioned souls who have no transcendental aspirations. They cannot truly understand what the spiritual world is like and what Krishna's intimate activities are like. Because undoubtedly they will mistake those activities to be, Krishna goes, he does things, he has girlfriends. Well, that I also have girlfriends, so what's the difficulty with my having girlfriends? Or why should I respect him? Because Vrindavan is the most intimate quarters of Krishna. And really to gain access into the complete understanding of this, one must be completely, completely trusted and trustworthy. And what is that trustworthiness? Anya vilasita sunyam jnanakama anavrita anukulena krishna anushilanam. That one's devotional service has no motivation attached to it, neither for karma or jnana, to gain something on the physical platform or on the mental platform, intellectual platform. There is no motivation in one's service to Krishna other than the simple and pure desire of love to please Krishna. That's pure devotional service. That makes one completely trustworthy. It's simple in one sense to understand, because one has no motivation other than to please Krishna. One is a devotee of Krishna, and therefore one, by definition, one is trustworthy. Because one has no other desire than to please Krishna. So if one has such a relationship with Krishna, truly, purely, then certainly Krishna will trust that person and he will invite such a person into the most confidential areas of existence, where he displays his most confidential and intimate activities with his most confidential and intimate devotees. This is how he actually gets his pleasure. And that is called Vrindavan. That place that is beyond all conception, that place where words cannot reach, where thoughts cannot reach, where the mind cannot reach, this transcendental realm is known as Vrindavan. This is the spiritual world. This is Goloka. And this is the subject matter of the 10th canto. But it has, one can't say it doesn't have anything to do with the material world, because the material world has so much to do with this Goloka Vrindavan. And again, it's a reflection. And everything that exists there in its pristine glory exists here in its reflected image. But the reflection and the reality, that thing which is being reflected in, for example, the mirror, certainly they have a relationship, but one cannot really compare them. And the next time one chooses to think he can compare them, one should try to eat the reflection of a samosa and some sabji and some dal and see if his hunger becomes satisfied. No, one wants the substance. The substance is the real thing. But yet there is a relationship between the reality, the truth, the actual food, and the reflection. There is a relationship because the reflection is a reflection. Cool. So, the Bhagavatam in the cantos preceding the 9th canto, excuse me, the 10th canto, 1 through 9, they prepare us and purify us and help us develop our relationship with Krishna. And to understand the 10th canto and to get some entrance into it and to not mistake Krishna's activities to be ordinary, because again, they mimic to some extent the activities of those in the material world. One, before one is completely on the transcendental platform, one has to understand that this is God, the Ishwara, the controller, the all-powerful one. He is the one that is performing these activities. And this is how he's getting his pleasure. Just like I remember in the 80s, there was some great news that spread around the world that the President of the United States, it was Ronald Reagan, he liked jelly beans. You know what is jelly bean? Yes, different colors.
Yeah, pink,
yellow, green, red. We especially like the red ones, maybe. But I don't think there are blue jelly beans, actually.
Black,
yes. So, this was thought of as so wonderful. It was in all the newspapers. Why? Why did it capture the attention of the people of the world? Because it wasn't ordinary. This was a glimpse of the activities of someone who was quite extraordinary and extremely powerful from the point of view of the material world. But if you think about it, there are thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people in this world who eat jelly beans. And so what? Who cares? This one person, he has this particular eating habit, and there are thousands and thousands of other people who have it. But when we understand who this person is, that he's so powerful and look what he does, then it becomes wonderful. Wonderful enough to attract their interest. So similarly, that Krishna performs these activities, when one understands, like if we say, there's a person who eats jelly beans, everyone will say, so what? And then you say, that person is the president of the United States. And everyone goes, oh, Anek Sundar, this is extremely wonderful. So Krishna performs his activities, untouched by the modes of material nature, but every single thing that he does is completely transcendental. What and wonderful. What is causing it to occur, the activities, has nothing to do with that which causes our activities to occur. And of course, this is inconceivable to us because we see through our own minds. And practically speaking, we're only seeing our minds when we look at the world. And a conditioned soul will only see his own mind when he looks at Krishna if he is just using his mind to examine it. Therefore, to understand Krishna, we take our minds, especially in Vrindavan, we take our minds, we take it from wherever it happens to be. Where do you keep yours? In your head or your heart? Well, anyway, take it from where it is, wrap it up into a small package, and put it in your back pocket. And don't listen to it during the time you're hearing about Krishna. Instead of listening to your mind, which will just project its own self upon Krishna, what we should do is listen to the pure minds of the great acharyas. Because through them, they will transparently tell us what is going on in the spiritual world. When Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is in his confidential quarters and he's dealing with his most intimate and dearest and most trusted devotees. This is what the great teachers will tell us. This is what the greatest teachers tell us. There are great teachers, there are greater teachers, and then there are greatest teachers. The great teachers tell us, you are not of this material world. You are spiritual. Do not try to enjoy here. The mediocre teachers and terrible teachers deal with the modes of material nature, tell us how to find some kind of pleasure within the realm of the modes of material nature. They're actually all lesser. They may be effective in teaching us that, but it is a lesser teaching. But the great teachers on these three levels, on the great level, they teach us that you don't belong, you are not of this material world. This material world is just a phantasmagoria. It is like smoke. It is like illusion. It is like the projection of a movie projector, that which is projected on the screen. There's nothing actually there. But what they tell us reality is, the great teachers, and they are transcendentalists, and one would have to say they're great teachers if they're actually following principles themselves and are renounced from the material world, which is actually very difficult. They say that the absolute truth is what you are, soham, you are that, and that has no form. And do you know what that realization of the absolute truth is compared to? It is consciousness of only of one's there's no consciousness of individuality. It is just a feeling of existence. And it's like deep sleep, where the miseries of material existence are removed. and material existence truly is suffering. So deep sleep, so when one has a deep sleep, a good deep sleep, one feels so refreshed because one has relieved oneself from the miseries of material existence for some time. What a relief. That's what the great teachers bring us to. And the greater teachers will add something to the point that we are not of this world. They will explain that Krishna is in your heart and he is all pervading as Paramatma. Of course, they won't say Krishna. But these are the yogis. They will show us that Ishvara Sahabhutanam Riddhishe Arjuna Dishite. He is in everyone's heart. And they teach us the practices of getting there. This is greater because it is through that Paramatma feature that is how Krishna is everywhere. But the greatest teachers, they bring us to the realm of Bhagawan. They bring us from the seeing the president in his office into the president's private quarters so we can get to meet him as a person and learn who he actually is and actually fall in love, in this case, with the most all-attractive, supremely wonderful person. Yet, those who love him the deepest, who have the most trusted and intimate, confidential relationships with him, they know that he, going back to the analogy of his being the president, they know he's the president. They know he's God. But they don't care. Their relationship with him is so intimate that it eclipses, covers over the knowledge that he is the Supreme Lord. It's the same person. It's the same person. The same person who is the government, who is the president, who is that individual who occupies the post, who eats jelly beans. It's only one person. But yet, it's just a matter of the depth of relationship. And the more, going back to the point of Krishna, the more one is qualified and develops the intimacy of relationship with him, the more ecstasy comes to the soul. Because the more Krishna awards ecstasy to the soul. And the soul doesn't even care about that. There are examples in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu Nectar devotion in the Bhagavatam where the devotees, they go into ecstasy. But if there's a choice between ecstasy and their loving service, they choose the loving service. They want the ecstasy to dissipate if it gets in the way of their loving service to Krishna. So the goal of their service is simply to serve out of love. It's not to gain the ecstasy that naturally comes through loving service. The goal is simply no goal except to please Krishna due to their love for him. There's no other goal. There's no other motive. Therefore, it's called ahaitiki. It is causeless. Their motivation isn't to gain anything. It is to give simply out of love. And it's therefore called again causeless. There is no cause other than its own natural affection. So what we're going to start hearing and in the classes that just finished here, the 14th chapter of the 10th canto has been discussed. But it's such a unique chapter in one sense, because someone who is not actually qualified to enter into the most
to observe the most intimate dealings of Krishna and his devotees is given a glimpse of these dealings. He's not actually qualified. He doesn't have the adhikar. He doesn't have the purity and depth and intimacy of love. Yet by Krishna's arrangement and by his own Rama's qualification, he's allowed to glimpse what's going on in Vrindavan. And that glimpse is inconceivable to him. It's not inconceivable to the residents of Vrindavan what goes on in Vrindavan. But the most qualified person in this world, due to purity and intelligence, Lord Brahma, when he gets a glimpse of what's going on in Vrindavan, he's completely staggered by it. Again, he's not actually qualified to see and to participate, rather. He's not qualified to participate. But Krishna has his plan. And one of the aspects of his plan is he wants Brahma to speak his realizations after getting a glimpse of Krishna and what's going on in Vrindavan. He's going to speak his realizations in the form of prayers. And that is the 14th chapter of the 10th canto. And it is very much based on this chapter that the Gaudiya Vaishnava Acharyas have proved that Krishna himself, not Lord Narayan, not Vishnu, is actually the fountainhead of all incarnations. We should remember that here we are sitting in one little town, one little insignificant isolated town on one little insignificant planet, and we think, oh, is this really true that an insignificant planet, but just look up on a clear night, look up at the sky and we'll see how many planets are there, how many stars and planets are there. There are thousands, practically uncountable numbers. That's even the ones that we can see with our eyes. And space goes on for millions and billions of miles. So truly, this planet is insignificant. And truly, this city is insignificant. And truly, this one individual here who's speaking is also insignificant. And this totality of existence within which I am situated in my insignificance, the totality of existence, of material existence. And again, it helps to every once in a while take a look up at the sky at night and see the planets. And understand that all this too is insignificant compared to one person whom an expansion of his expansion of his expansion of his expansion, all this is emanating from. And that one person who's controlling everything, who is the source of everything. And when we say everything, we mean everything. Think of something, anything. He's the source of it. All the planets, all the seas, all the creatures. That one person is living in Vrindavan with his most trusted and dearest. And he's playing his flute and he's herding the cows. But when he's doing that, he's still that same person. He's still that same person who universes come and go. Like when we breathe, the air comes in and out. city so beautifully in Vrindavan, playing with his cowboy boyfriends, wandering around the beautiful land of Vrindavan, shoeless, playing games with his friends. Well, I play games with my friends, so therefore, no. Take your mind and put it in your back pocket and listen to what the acharyas say about this beautiful boy who is so wonderful, who lives in the transcendental realm of Vrindavan, and who tell us that we are very fortunate to hear about him. So where we're up to in this pastime of Krishna, just in the beginning of the 14th chapter, is that Krishna has just killed an asura. What does an asura mean? Commonly known as? No? Demon. Demon. Asura. Coming. It is kind of jargon, and asura means demon. A demon who is against the authority of Krishna. And in fact, this one demon, Agasura, sinful demon, sinful asura, he wanted to kill Krishna because Krishna had the audacity to kill his demonic brother and sister, who were Bakasura and Putana. So, it's so interesting that there's so many tales, mythological tales and fairy tales and comic book tales and this and that of heroes who save the day and who do good or something like that. And everyone is interested in hearing of those heroes, even though somehow it satisfies a need that people have. But the real hero is this one, this Krishna. Because he's all powerful. But there's a tendency for the mind to say, wait a second, this sounds like stories. I've heard so many stories. And then just take your mind, because your story is all that you're not, it's nothing but your mind that you're talking about. And just for the time being, just hear what the acharyas say about this hero, this superhero, this supreme personality of Godhead. So after Krishna killed Agasura in a wonderful way, Lord Brahma saw what had happened. Lord Brahma, of course, is the secondary creator of the universe, of one universe. And he was not an asura, not demonic, but he couldn't quite accept that this little boy was his master. He was the greatest, most intelligent. Most intelligent means most perceptive. He perceived most, because intelligence means you perceive reality. You perceive more of reality than someone who is less intelligent. So Brahma perceived more of reality of the material, what was going on in the material universe, than any other living being. He had more knowledge. He was the king of jnana, practically speaking, of all knowledge. It was an interesting way to look at it. He perceived more of reality. So he saw what was going on, that this little boy had killed this big demon, Agasura, in the shape of a snake. But he's a little boy, and I'm so powerful, Brahma thought. And he's a little boy, and he's herding cows, and I'm so powerful. And he's wandering around the land of Vrindavan with his friends and playing tag, touching them and playing games and pushing each other and stealing each other's lunch baskets. And I'm so powerful. So with his conception of reality, which was greater than any other being's perception and conception of reality in the universe, he was measuring Krishna by that. And a part of him knew that he was the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but there was another part of him, the measuring part, that couldn't accept it. So he wanted to test to see what, let's see Krishna do something to prove a little more. Actually, when Akura takes Krishna from Vrindavan, and Krishna reveals, Krishna and Balaram are sitting on the chariot in Akura Ghat on the border of Vrindavan and Mathura, and they have, Akura has went to bathe, and in the waters he saw the Vishnu form. He actually saw the Lord's Vishnu form with his four arms lying upon the Anantashesha. He saw that. And he was amazed. Because to see something spiritual with pure eyes is certainly amazing. Even to get a glimpse of something spiritual in a purified heart is amazing, because it is, what can one say, it is non-material. Even to look at the deities over time and become absorbed in the beauty of the deities, or to become absorbed in Krishna's names, or to become absorbed in the Bhagavatam, it is quite astounding for the consciousness, because it is spiritual, it is wonderful, it is transcendental, it gives nourishment to the soul, to the self. So, Akura saw Lord Vishnu lying on Anantashesha, and in the water. And he came out of the water and he saw Krishna and Balaram upon the chariot. And Krishna, in his cute way, said to Akura, "Oh, Uncle Akura, you look astounded. Did you see something wonderful in the water or something? You've just seen Vishnu." And Akura very perceptively and intelligently and sweetly answered, "When I'm seeing you, what could be more wonderful? Because Krishna is the source of all wonderful things, including Mahavishnu. He is the most wonderful, the most transcendentally satisfying, the most, most wonderful." So Brahma, trying to measure Krishna, he was actually seeing the most wonderful thing. Krishna playing with his coward boyfriends in Vrindavan. There's nothing more wonderful than that. Because this is the president in his most intimate quarters. He's not acting, showing his power. He's just enjoying with his most confidential, dearest beloveds. But Brahma wasn't qualified to perceive it in that way, even though he was the most perceptive perceiver of reality in the entire universe. He wasn't qualified to see it. So he began to measure it. And he thought, "Let me see if this is really Krishna. Let me see if we can make Krishna do something wonderful." He was already seeing the most wonderful thing.
So what did he do? He took the boys and cows and hid them. What will Krishna do, he thought. Let's see. I have my powers. Let's see what Krishna will do. So Brahma took them for a short amount of his time, which was 1 year according to our earthly calculation. And he came back and he saw most wonderfully that the cows and boys were still there. Krishna teaches in his own way. He teaches in many ways, of course. He teaches through the spiritual masters. He teaches through his words, the Bhagavad Gita. He teaches through the words spoken about him. He teaches through the holy name. He teaches in so many ways. He presents things externally to us that we can absorb from the outside in, but he also teaches from the inside out. He arranges circumstances so that we can come to our own conclusions, because he says so many things again and again and again, but we put our hands on our hips and say, well, how do I know it's really true? And how do I know this? And how do I know that? You can't make me believe this. I can't be forced to accept it. So Krishna teaches us from without and from within. And from within, as the super soul, Krishna arranges, I'm shifting it a little bit, but Krishna arranges us to perceive things, or our life, things that are happening to us, in such a way that we actually reach the conclusions ourselves and want to open ourselves to Krishna's, to deepen our understanding of Krishna consciousness. So Krishna did that to Brahma. He could have gone to Brahma and said, Brahma, you have taken my cows and calves. I know everything. Now give them back. But no, because Brahma already knew Krishna was the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and he wanted to test further. So those direct instructions didn't work, so he wanted to show something to Brahma. So Brahma came back and saw the cows and boys were still there. He was shocked because he knew that he had taken them away. And then, just to turn up the heat on the realization a little bit, those forms of the cows and boys began manifesting four arms and showing themselves to be all-powerful Vishnu, because Brahma knew that Vishnu was the Supreme Lord, because he was born of Garbhadaksha Vishnu, and Vishnu had previously, or he had revealed this to him previously. And he was shocked to be confronted with this incredible display of spiritual power. There were, in Australian language, there were heaps of Vishnus there. There were so many. Also, and each one of them was supremely opulent, and each one was covered from head to toe with tulsi leaves, and each one was being worshipped by all the demigods, by unlimited Brahmas and Shivas, and each one was being worshipped by all the material elements, and each one was being worshipped. Each of the Vishnu forms was all powerful and being worshipped by every single living entity, from the ants and Indra Gopas upward. Because ultimately, we cannot avoid worshipping Krishna. It is unavoidable. We worship him directly or indirectly. That was one of the first questions I asked Prabhupada. being so clever, I said to Prabhupada, if we cannot avoid worshipping Krishna, we either worship him, serve him through his maya, or serve him directly, then why change anything? We're already serving Krishna. So why bother doing anything different? And Prabhupada answered in one sentence, if you worship directly, you are happy, and if you worship indirectly, you will be miserable. Because the indirect worship means competing with Krishna, trying to act as if we're God, and getting crushed by his material energy. But yet, we're still playing within the realm of his material energy and his worship. In a way, we are submitting fully and serving his material energy. We can't avoid it. So every living entity, Brahma saw, was serving Krishna. Every single living entity. There's this incredible display of opulence. And Brahma was trembling. And there he was, the most knowledgeable, perceptive living entity in the universe. And he was shocked. He was shocked by this display of opulence. And there was Krishna, just standing there. And the Vishnus turned back and forth into cowherd boys. And Krishna was just standing there. So Brahma will be just the end of this chapter in the Krishna book. And then tomorrow, we'll, if Krishna allows, we'll begin to hear some of Brahma's prayers. When Brahma, so then Krishna withdrew all the opulence too, because Brahma was getting more and more bewildered and more confused. When Brahma was relieved from his perplexity, he appeared to be awakened from an almost dead state, and he began to open his eyes with great difficulty. Thus he could see the eternal cosmic manifestation with common eyes. He saw all around him the super excellent view of Vrindavan, full with trees, which is the source of life for all living entities. He could appreciate the transcendental land of Vrindavan, where all the living entities are transcendental to ordinary nature. In the forest of Vrindavan, even ferocious animals like tigers and others live peacefully along with the deer and human beings. He could understand that because of the presence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in Vrindavan, that place is transcendental to all other places, and that there is no lust and greed there. Brahma thus found Sri Krishna. So this is when Krishna withdrew the vision of opulences, and Brahma could see Vrindavan again. And he understood this place is completely transcendental. And Brahma found Sri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, playing the part of a small cowherd boy. He saw that little child with a lump of food in his left hand, searching out his friends, cows and calves, just as he was actually doing 1 year before, after their disappearance, after Brahma had taken them away. Immediately, now Brahma had seen something. He had his realization. He was shocked. He was awed. So immediately Brahma descended from his great swan carrier and fell down before the Lord like a golden stick. The word used amongst the Vaishnavas for offering respects is dandavat. I once read, because the devotees, not so much ISKCON devotees, when they see each other, they say dandavat. And Prabhupada said, you should not just say dandavat, you should do dandavat. Because people would see Prabhupada or something and say, dandavat Maharaj. And just to say it isn't the same as actually offering obeisances. So he fell down before the Lord like a golden stick. Despite his great position, he understood his own insignificance. The word The word means falling down like a stick. One should offer respects to the superior Vaishnava by falling down straight with his body just like a stick. So Brahma fell down before the Lord like a stick to offer obeisances. And because the complexion of Brahma is golden, he appeared to be like a golden stick lying down before Lord Krishna. Even today, you see, in the old days, the brahmacharis, they took it that you'd have to, when you offered your obeisances, you'd hold yourself like a stick straight and go, yeah, even today you see people doing that. Yes? You still do that, Yadu?
No.
You broke your nose. How many times? But I would assume it means that you're supposed to lie on the offer obeisances like a stick. Fall on the ground and lie like a stick. That's only an ISKCON habit, yes? Huh?
Also, devotees that fall asleep in class, they stand up.
They fall asleep like a stick. Yeah, that's different though. One time there was one devotee, this was back in the 70s, who had a habit of falling asleep while chanting japa. So he used to stand up and he'd walk and he'd still fall asleep. And he'd be falling asleep, of course, because he was sleeping so few hours a night. And he was still falling asleep and staggering around. And I said to him, Prabhu, that looks peculiar. And he said, just imagine how it feels. So all the four helmets on the heads of Brahma touched the lotus feet of Krishna. Brahma, being very joyful, began to shed tears because his illusion was gone. We hold so tightly to our illusion, but we become joyful when we give it up. Our illusion means to always be wanting to think of our significance. And that's our illusion, thinking we're significant. But how could we be anything but insignificant, in fact? So Brahma being very joyful, so to give up illusion makes one joyful. And he washed the lotus feet of Krishna with his tears. Repeatedly he fell and rose as he recalled the wonderful activities of the Lord. After repeating obeisances for a long time, Brahma stood up and smeared his hands over his eyes to wipe his tears away. And seeing the Lord before him, he trembling, and here is the most powerful person in the universe, he began to offer prayers with great respect, humility, and attention. Okay, thank you very much. That was the preface. Try to bring us, to give us some, even though we're unqualified to enter Vrindavan, by the wonderful prayers of Brahma, we'll get a glimpse of Krishna. But from the perspective of someone who perceives more of reality than anyone else in the world, universe. Okay. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Lord Brahma ki jai, Gaur Prabhupada.